Today on The Whistleblowers, U.S. Manifest Destiny apparently includes Greenland now. Acquiring Greenland will no doubt put President Trump in the history books. It's actually bigger than the Louisiana Purchase, and that's pretty darn big. But will it be the end of NATO? And could that be President Trump's ulterior motive? I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Whistleblowers. President Trump says we need Greenland for national security. Take a listen.
We need it for national. We need Greenland for national security, not for minerals. We have so many sites for minerals and oil and everything. We have more oil than any other country in the world. We need Greenland for national security. And if you take a look at Greenland, you look up and down the coast. You have Russian and Chinese ships all over the place.
The argument is convincing. The race for the Arctic has been ongoing for over a decade now, with Russia, the United States, and other northern nations competing at the top of the globe for fossil fuel resources, rare earth metals, and trade routes. And it is plausible that in the event of aggression from, say, China or Russia, Denmark could do little to defend the massive territory of Greenland. But I'll be blunt. It's highly unlikely. First of all, Denmark is a member of NATO. Any attack on Greenland would trigger Article 5 of NATO. Second, no nation on Earth has the capability to bring force to bear on Greenland and to sustain it against the might of the United States and its allies. And third, there are already around 200 U.S. troops in Greenland stationed at the Pituffik Space Base. So what is this really all about? Well, that's a tough question, actually, but this could be one way for the Trump administration to draw down its commitment to NATO. The administration's National Security Strategy document, published in November 2025, already pointed the way to greater disengagement with Europe. The document says, quote, America is understandably sentimentally attached to the European continent and, of course, to Britain and Ireland. We want to work with aligned countries that want to restore their former greatness, unquote. Ouch, though. It sounds like the old breakup strategy. I still love you. I'm just not in love with you. And now President Trump is going full on sanctions against European countries unless a, quote, deal is made on Greenland. So what's next? Purchase? Occupation? War? To answer all of this and more, we're joined by our guest today, Alex Craner. Alex is a geopolitical analyst and global markets expert. Alex, thanks so much for joining us. Good to see you.
Thank you for the invite, John. Great pleasure to be with you today.
Thank you, sir. So Greenland, important for U.S. geostrategy, perhaps especially in the Arctic. How much of an actual threat do Russia and China pose to Greenland and Denmark?
I believe, John, that the rhetoric, the narrative of the Chinese and Russian threat is just a cover for Trump to do what Trump wants to do. My interpretation would be a little bit different. I believe that when Trump and Putin met in Anchorage, Alaska, last August, I think that this came out of the meeting, I think, from Kirill Dmitriev's tweets. They were talking about strategic cooperation mm-hmm. on strategic developments in the Arctic, which are extremely important to the Russians and to the Chinese. Why? Because the Arctic represents the new alternative trade route between East and West. So for the last hundred and so many years, the entire West depended on the Suez route, right? So you had trade coming in from Asia through the Red Sea, through Suez, and then to the Mediterranean and through Gibraltar out towards the Northwest Europe. Mm-hmm. And the British Empire positioned itself strategically to control all the choke points along that route so that they could control the trade. And the Russians, as well as the Chinese, have been developing alternative trade routes One of them is the International North-South Corridor, or I butchered that, North-South International Corridor, which goes from the Indian Ocean up across Iran, the Caspian region, towards Moscow and St. Petersburg, and from there it can go to Northwest Europe. And that route is considerably, I think, about one-third cheaper and faster than the Suez route. And it's not controlled by the Western Empire. And then the second alternative is the Arctic route, which has become a strategic direction for the Russians, who have built something like 60 icebreakers. I think five or six or maybe more of them are nuclear icebreakers. And the intent is to keep that route open all year round. And so the Chinese and the Russians are welcoming the United States to join these strategic developments because they're very, very important. And, you know, the role of the United States in the world is so important that if you have the United States on your side, your agenda, your platform is viable. If the United States is not on your side, well, then, you know, you potentially always have a very powerful adversary who could scuttle your plans. I think it's for this reason that Trump, well, this and other reasons why Trump wants to finally get full control of Greenland. But, you know, you cannot come out in the open and say it exactly in these terms. Why? Because for generations now, we have been brainwashed with the idea that the Russians and the Chinese, communists, right, they're our adversaries, they're our enemies. Whereas Western Europeans, the British, the French, the Germans, the Dutch and Danish and so forth, they're the allies, they're the enemies. So Trump couldn't come up to the American people and say, hey, you know what, I'm going to just flush our friends and allies down the toilet, and I'm going to make friends with our enemies, with the evil Russians and the evil Chinese, right? So he has to dress it up in the cellophane of like, oh, we have to take Greenland because if we don't, then the Russians and the Chinese will take it, and then we're going to have a huge problem. And this is something that the whole, you know, entrenched cold warrior mindset can digest and agree with, whereas the other rhetoric would be much, much more challenging, and people would oppose Trump's idea. But, you know, the desire of the United States to take control of Greenland is not something that Trump invented. This goes back, I think, over 100 years. Mm-hmm. And various U.S. presidents and administrations have wanted to buy Greenland off of from the Danish. But it seems that Trump is now very determined to do it. And how he's going to finagle it is difficult to see, but let's watch.
You've actually anticipated my next question. And that is, what do you make of this idea that this might have something to do with Trump's desire to pull out from NATO or to lessen the import of NATO in American foreign policy? And as it relates to this national security strategy document from last November, it seems that there may be actually something to that.
Yeah, well, you know, NATO has been created. NATO probably should never have been created, let's put it that way. NATO came into existence, if I'm not mistaken, in 1948 as an opposition bloc to the Soviet Union.
Right.
To the Soviet Union. There was no Soviet bloc until, I think, 1952. This was a British geopolitical strategy that was kind of grafted onto the American government and their system, because the British never quite gave up their fantasy and their obsession of destroying Russia. And we know that even towards the very end of World War II, that the British wanted to turn World War II against the Soviet Union. There was that famous Operation Unthinkable, right? Which fortunately, Dwight Eisenhower rejected, but the idea was to gang up together, the British, the Americans, and whatever was remaining of the German troops and the Polish manpower,
right,
and to launch a sudden attack against Russia, against the Soviets. Eisenhower rejected that, and then the alternative in the Operation Unthinkable was a very, very long-term project of preparing the ground for the next phase of attack against Russia, and that, I think, entailed creation of NATO. So already, so this Operation Unthinkable was already on Winston Churchill's desk in, I think, April 1945, before the World War II was properly over. The Americans rejected it, but then once FDR was out of the way, there was that famous Fulton speech, the Iron Curtain speech, where Winston Churchill, in front of U.S. President Harry Truman, declared the Soviet Union to be the enemy of the West. Soviet Union, which was an ally just, you know, the day before that,
right,
and which has shredded at least 80% of the Nazi military might. So, you know, like, instead of world coming together in partnership and friendship to build a common future, the British declared that the Soviets were an enemy now. Now, that's a very powerful enemy. So what did they do? They said, like, hey, let's organize the like-minded country into a military bloc. So they created NATO. And then they kept adding countries to NATO in many phases. But and then the Soviets responded only after Western Germany was added to NATO, which is, I think, in 1952. And then the Soviets declared the Warsaw Pact, right, which means that, you know, they organized an opposing a military alliance consisting of the Soviet Russia with Eastern European countries like Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, Bulgaria, Romania, and so forth. And so now you had two blocks, and then you had 30, 40 years of Cold War. The issue that comes back to the present moment is that the United States has been funding all this with something like 90% of the money needed to maintain the NATO structure and the alliance, and then provided the military technology and the space technology and the logistical support and most of the manpower and so forth. And basically, the United States was footing the bill, while the spoils of this situation were, I think, disproportionately allocated to Western European powers. So, you know, the American people said, enough of this, you know, why are we doing this? And, you know, when they had a chance to elect somebody who would put a stop to it, which was Donald Trump, they elected Donald Trump. And so I absolutely agree with what you say. I think that Trump's idea with getting a hold of Greenland is also, you know, one stone, two flies, to extricate the United States from NATO, and to break the NATO apart. Because, okay, another moment going back to Anchorage, Alaska, August last year, the main objective ostensibly of their discussions between Putin and Trump was solving the war in Ukraine. But if you recall, it wasn't just let's stop the fighting in Ukraine. It was let's solve the causes of this conflict. And the conclusion was that a whole new security architecture was needed, not just for Ukraine and between Ukraine and Russia, but for the whole of Europe and Western Asia. Mm-hmm. So I believe that they're still working on that blueprint, and that this also is part of the reason why Trump wants out of NATO, and why the Trump administration is supporting sovereigntist movements in Europe rather than a united European Union, which has become its own greatest enemy meanwhile.
Alex, stay right there. Stay with us. When we come back, more on the possible breakup going on over at NATO headquarters as we discuss Greenland. So stay tuned. This is The Whistleblowers. Welcome back. Today on the show, we're discussing Donald Trump's insistence that the United States take possession of Greenland. We're joined by Alex Craner. He's a geopolitical and global markets analyst. Alex, thanks again for being with us.
Thank you for the invite.
Alex, President Putin recently said this about President Trump's ambitions in Greenland.
In fact, the United States had such plans as early as the 1860s. Even then, the American administration was considering the possibility of annexing Greenland and Iceland. But the idea did not receive the support of Congress at the time. Incidentally, I would like to remind you that by 1868, American newspapers were ridiculing the purchase of Alaska.
Could this backfire, do you think, in the sense that with the U.S. essentially leaving Europe right now, Germany and Russia could become the natural allies that on paper, at least, they appear to be?
Well, you know, depends on how you look at this, you know, because the Trump administration, from the very beginning of this second term, have declared themselves in favor of multipolar integrations rather than the post-World War II global order. Multipolar integrations mean that, you know, they accept that they are a major power amidst other powers like Russia, like China, and so forth. The cooperation between Russia and Germany in that case shouldn't be a problem. You know, it only is a big problem if you want to create a one world global government, and you need everybody else to be bludgeoned into submission to you. Everybody else needs to be a vassal. So if you let go of this construct and you accept that, you know, China is a power with its rightful place in the world, and so is Russia, and so is Germany, and so forth, and then you are a polite guest at the global banquet, and you trade with other people on a fair basis, and have a respectful relation with other nations, then a relationship, a productive, constructive relationship between Russia and Germany is not necessarily a problem. And one thing that we learned about the last big meeting between Vladimir Putin and Steve Witkoff, which was held, what was it, in January? It's going so fast, I have a hard time remembering. Remember when they spent about 5 hours sitting together, maybe it was December of last year. But one of the things that they discussed was the reconnecting of Nord Stream pipelines, because out of four tubes, one is intact. And so Germany could be supplied with, you know, 25% of the full capacity of Nord Stream system. And so the interesting aspect to this is that it was discussed between the Americans and the Russians. There was no German delegation there. So, you know, to me, that signifies that the Trump administration is already counting with the Merz government falling and probably AfD, the German Sovereignist Party, forming the next government. And so they're already preparing the groundwork, which all works together with what we just discussed moments ago, that there needs to be a completely new security architecture for Europe. And I think that little by little, they're putting the pieces in place. Mm-hmm. So if that is the intent, then a positive relationship between Russia and Germany is not a problem. This is only a problem if you take the standpoint of British geopolitics, where, you know, London has to rule over everyone and everybody else has to submit to them like a vassal.
Alex, where are the rifts right now within Europe opposing a stronger unified front against the U.S.? Are Germany, the U.K. and France all on the same page here?
It does appear to be the case that Germany, France and the United Kingdom are on the same page. And you will notice that all three nations are ruled by governments that are extremely close to the, you know, Western financial establishment, to the banking establishments. Emmanuel Macron is a former Rothschild banker. Friedrich Merz in Germany is a former CEO of German office of the BlackRock company. And then Keir Starmer, you know, he basically works under the City of London, under right. Bank of England. I mean, right. you know, it's not overtly so. It's not declared to be so. But, you know, Liz Truss has said many times that the real power, and she used to be the prime minister, right, that the real power in Britain is wielded by the Bank of England. And yes. then, you know, Keir Starmer is, I think, a sock puppet of Tony Blair. And Tony Blair is Mr. City of London, you know, the knight companion of the most noble order of the Garter. You know, he is the City of London incarnate.
Yes, indeed. What route does Trump take if Europe refuses a deal on Denmark? And the reason I ask that is there are so many cases in which Donald Trump makes an outrageous policy statement. Everybody panics. They rush to the negotiating table, and then they come out with something in the middle. It's like a little negotiating ploy, a little trick that he uses. Is that what we're seeing here?
Yeah, I think that's clear by now. I mean, you know, Donald Trump is a disciple of Roy Cohn, which means that in negotiations, his opening gambit is to act like a bastard, like a gangster. You know, he comes with, you know, if he wants to walk away with 100, he walks into the negotiations demanding 500, banging his fist on the table and saying, if you don't give me 500, I'm going to hurt you. And then when you say, well, I can only give you 100, then he goes like, well, all right, you know, because it's you, I'll, you know. And then you feel like you gave him everything he wanted, but you feel like you got off lightly.
Yes, so he did you a favor.
That's apparently his style. And I think that with respect to the European powers, he has many, many levers. You know, the very obvious one is the tariff. The next one is their defense and security, because the United States is the foundation of Europe's security, you know, in terms of military defense. Then, you know, the global trade is still conducted in U.S. dollars, you know, for things like oil and gas and coal and the main foodstuffs like rice and wheat and corn and so forth. And so, you know, every European country needs to purchase those items in U.S. dollars. Mm-hmm. And European banks are very short on dollars. And so the way that the United States has been helping them is they have these virtually unlimited swap lines where European banks that finance international trade can tap into Fed supply of U.S. dollars, post euro balances, and the trade moves on. Otherwise, they would have to buy the dollars, which would probably be very bad for the euro, very good for the dollar. And in order to avoid doing that, the Fed has basically created like a perpetual bailout scheme for them. Well, you know, the Fed can close those swap lines, and then the Europeans would find themselves in a world of trouble. Right. And I think that Euro would possibly go into a free fall, and we might find ourselves with shortages of oil and shortages of wheat and coffee and sugar and things like this. So right. there's all kinds of levers that Trump could. Okay, this is not something that Trump can do. This is something that the Fed can do. But, you know, with a new Fed chairman that Trump is nominating, he will probably be able to lean on him. Jay Powell has been reluctant to play hardball with the Europeans, but who knows, maybe the next Fed chairman will be a bit more favorable to Trump's ideas.
We have just a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask you, since we're discussing Europe so much, what are your thoughts about the Ukraine war? How do you see this playing out in 2026?
It appears to me that Ukraine is very close to capitulation. And I think that it's being let go even by their most fanatical supporters, because it's starting to cost an enormous amount of money. You know, before the United States was picking up a huge portion of the tab, This is no longer the case. And now we learned, I think just today or yesterday, that Washington Post just sacked their Kiev correspondent. And she, you know, poor thing, she was spent the night in the car to keep warm. And then while she was in the car, she found out that she got sacked. And, you know, the reason why I think this is significant is because one of the main ways in which Western powers have been supporting Ukraine is through control of the narrative. So the, you know, the role of local journalists and the whole propaganda machinery was very important. And now the fact that Washington Post is getting rid of their Kiev correspondent tells me that they're simply washing their hands, that they are cutting their losses. And I believe that Ukraine's capitulation is probably not far down the line.
Alex Craner, thank you so much. Alex is a geopolitical and market analyst, and we were very happy to have him here. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Who would have ever thought that we would be living through a U.S. president threatening a NATO country over Greenland, of all places? But who then could have predicted the conflict in Ukraine starting almost 4 years ago now? I think the point to remember is that the world, at least in terms of geopolitics, is changing, and it's changing quickly. The old rules that governed the 20th century after World War II are giving way to something completely different, and we need to be watchful and wary. That's what we're here to do. So we hope you keep turning in. That's our show for today. Please subscribe to my Substack at John Kiriakou. Stay informed, and as always, keep asking the hard questions. I'm John Kiriakou. Thanks for watching The Whistleblowers.